Writer Stephen Stafford believes there are three different kinds of funny people: Godzillas, Mothras, and Gamoras. Godzillas kill you with a never-ending series of jokes. Mothras make you laugh your head off with that one outrageous line everyone will always remember. And the Gamoras possess a silly attitude that allows them to glide with ease through life.
Today, Stephen joins us to talk about his new play, Small Jokes About Monsters, which portrays a family at odds with each other after reading a devastating letter written by their dead father. Also joining us is queer actor Esteban Cruz, who stars in the play as Ryan. Listen as we chat with Stephen and Esteban about the play and how family members each use humor differently to cope with crisis.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Unlock a delicious world of podcasting magic and listen to thousands of amazing shows at feastoffun.com/plus.
Jokes About Monsters, a new dark comedy about a family at odds with each other. Three brothers rent a beach house after their estranged father's funeral to open up the envelope their father left them. When their mother shows up, truths are revealed and tempers flare. The new play kicks off the 12th season of Chicago's 16th Street Theater and runs until February 16th. A lot of numbers there, folks. Joining us today is the show's writer, Stephen Stafford, which you guys might remember for his one-man award-winning show, Methtacular.
Hello.
And also the derpy-eyed, adorable Esteban Andres Cruz, star of Harold and Kumar's Christmas 3 in 3D.
Hello.
Welcome. Hey, do you
and
see
Jeff
our
Jeff Award-winning actor?
And Jeff Award-winning actor. Did you see our Christmas tree, Pepe? Where are the decorations?
I don't know. Tio, my eyes all fucked up.
Yay! Thank you so much for indulging us with that. Welcome to Feast of Fun. This is
our back, both of you.
15th season. Speaking of numbers, throwing out there, honey.
Congratulations.
Yes, and it feels so good. Ooh. Yes. So, Stephen, this is a departure for you in the sense that you're sort of well known for writing your solo shows that are very autobiographical. Mm-hmm. And this play certainly draws upon the histories of works like Terrence McNally, Edward Albee, and even a little bit Tyler Perry in there.
I enjoy all of those references. After writing Methtacular, everyone kept saying to me, "What are you working on now?" And so, because I am easily persuaded to do more things, I would be like, oh, I guess I should write something else. And I started to write one piece that's actually coming up soon. But in the meantime, I started to write this opening scene of what turned out to be this play. And because I've had this theory about funny people since I was in college, that there are three kinds of funny people.
You start off the show with the main character played by Esteban talking about humor and how individuals react to humor, deliver humor. You said there's three types of funny people.
Yes. I believe that there are three kinds of funny people. There are Godzillas, Mothras, and Gamoras. Godzillas are the sort of people who you describe as funny. They're always making jokes. Uh-huh. They're constantly, it seems like a compulsion, with them. They are funny people.
And that's how you describe yourself.
That is how I would describe myself. Yeah. And that although I am seen as funny, I don't usually say the thing that everybody remembers. And that person who stays silent most of the time, but then says the thing that everybody laughs at and talks about for a long time is called a Mothra. And then Gamoras are my favorite subset of.
And that would be more like Mark. Mark's usually quiet, but when he delivers a line, it's with impeccable timing.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. And I believe that all Godzillas really wish they had the.
I'm also controlled by two little Asian women in the box. is that what Mothra is called?
I think so. It's a puppet.
Yes.
And then there's a third category, third kind, where I fit in.
Is the Gamera, who's someone who's not necessarily intending to be funny, but because they're so themselves, they engender laughs in a room. The best example I have of this is my very good friend Danielle. We used to all be working in a restaurant, and everyone would be talking about something, and she would walk up, and without any hello or anything, she'd always just go, "What?" As if she had been there and just not heard. And it was always such an odd choice. And it made us all laugh. But then we would be like, oh, and then we'd just catch her up on something. But she wasn't intending to be funny. It was just the way she navigates the world is slightly different than the rest of us. So those are the three kinds of funny people. And I think that everybody is a combination of all three, depending on your surroundings and things like that.
And the reason I compare this play to sort of like Edward Albee, Terrence McNally, you know, they're all sort of draw their inspiration from Tennessee Williams plays, and certainly Tyler Perry's on that category, where all the characters are in one room together, mm-hmm. and they're boxing with each other's emotions.
Yes.
And, you know, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is what great example is. Like, it's revealed that the reason they're fighting or there's tension in the room is because there's a dark secret that's being kept.
Yes.
Underground, and the secret gets revealed, and that becomes the driving force for the dramatization.
Yeah, I think that I'm fascinated by family, and I'm fascinated by the notion that we become different people out in the world.
Sure.
You know, you can go out and create this whole new persona and this whole new life for yourself, and the second you get around your family again, you are the exact same person you were every
it's
step
so
of the
true.
Way.
Yep, it's
and,
so true.
And so I was interested in... When I was writing the opening of the play, I set it between characters based on myself and my two brothers. And I thought, what would it take for these three people to stop joking with each other? And so I made things dark, and then I made things darker, and then I made things darker. And what I found out was I actually don't think I personally would stop joking, just that the jokes would stop being funny. Mm. They would start being either dangerous or painful.
Mm.
And so I was just sort of interested in that sort of, if we think of humor as a defense mechanism, which I do, then what happens when it is no longer a defense mechanism, but an offense mechanism, mm. you know?
So. Well, humor's a coping mechanism. Esteban, which one of the three Japanese horror film monsters do you identify as?
Well, Ryan, the character that I play yeah. is definitely Godzilla, but I personally feel more like a Gamera myself, because I stumble into comedy and it's not really my intention. It's just natural.
That's we're accidental comedians.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you don't have to. And this is the thing about like our approach is that we don't have to try to be funny. Yeah. We just have to live our lives authentically.
Yeah. Yeah. My life is pretty funny. Yeah.
And Faust's mom says he's most funniest when he's actually trying to be serious. Like, you're like, you're serious about this?
Oh, and your God, mom is hilarious. She's so funny.
She adores you so much.
I love your mom.
You know, so Esteban, this is certainly like you're in Chicago here. You're kind of a hotshot LA actor. You're in all kinds of films and TV shows and stuff. And now you started doing a regional theater. I kept expecting, like, you know, Madea to show up and be like, put people in their place, you know? I mean, like, there's a scene in the play where it's like, I could have sworn and one of the actors said, all my life I've been fighting. Well, I'm tired of fighting no more.
Oh, my God.
The truth is finally going to come out, mama. I feel like, you know, in a lot of ways, like, it's interesting to see you in this as the lead actor in this role, because in a lot of ways it's something that's very Chicago to me. And you're sort of that become this industrial actor. How are you getting ready for this role? Like, changed you or affected you? Or
Chicago has been so great in welcoming me back and considering me a Chicago actor, which is, you know, obviously those are my roots.
Mm-hmm.
And just the aesthetic of work that we do at 16th Street Theater is natural. And it's an intimate space, you know, it's 60 seats. So we're not playing to the rafters in there, you know. So doing that kind of work is something that definitely helps you when you're working on film and television. naturalism. And that's, you know, that's what I teach. It's what I do. And so it was great to come back to Chicago and do a play with that kind of aesthetic. And specifically with this character, you mentioned that laughter is a coping mechanism. And early in the process, I had confided in the director, Christina Vallada-Vires, and said, I don't feel like I'm smart enough to play Ryan. And that was later I was able to articulate that what I meant in that and what I was experiencing was he has a very sophisticated way of coping with the lies that he tells to himself and to other people. And me, I'm just an open book. Like, you know everything about, I'll tell, I have secrets, but I'll tell you if you want to know. And so Ryan and I are very different in that way. And I like to live in the emotion and just let it pass over me. And early in the process, I was doing that and feeling all the things that he would come at him. But then once I realized he had this mechanism of suppressing and you know, doing all of these coping tactics, it was safer for me. And the job became easier because I didn't have to go through this emotional journey. Knowing it and having experienced it, it was good to do. But at the end of the day, it was a very meticulous dance around these issues and how to navigate where blame is placed and who is trying to take my victimhood away.
Sure.
And then to lash back out at them. So I never let any of those big things settle into me. They're always tools that I use at my disposal right in front of me. So me, Esteban, at the end of the show, I'm just fine because I didn't have to go through all these things because Ryan doesn't go through all of those things. He looks
so the character is sort of like in denial of a lot of his feelings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. And, you know, and we'll, one of the elements that we deal with in the play is addiction and recovery. And he's also in denial about that, too. So he just hasn't had, you know, thank God I've had the therapy and the experience that I'm in a much different place than Ryan is, you know, emotionally in my development.
But Stephen, this lead character is in a lot of sense autobiographical for you.
Yeah, for sure. This is sort of a version of, you know, I got clean and sober about 11 years ago, 11 and a half years ago now. And this is sort of, I refer to it as my It's a Wonderful Life. So it's like sort of
what
the version
of
me.
Happened if, yeah, you didn't,
if I didn't
quit.
And I think what would have happened.
And you were like a regular meth addict.
I was in my early 20s. And then replaced that with alcohol and honestly anything I could get my hands on. As long as I didn't do meth. I thought I was doing great.
Well,
and then
yeah,
I was like, well, I'm not doing meth. And like, meanwhile, I'm doing enough coke to kill me. But, you know, but fine. It's fine.
You've had a really rough and tumble
I've lived
early
a
years.
Lot of lives.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because now, you know, I'm just like, you know, I'm married to a teacher and we have like a nice condo and it's just like, I have a very sort of nice day-to-day life. I perform in musicals and everything's fine.
You're in Spamalot.
I wasn't Spamalot. Yeah. And I've been very fortunate to work in a bunch of musicals around town here and it's, I have a nice steady life. But certainly, everything leading up to it, was full of, chaos. And so the version of me that's in this show is the, unchanged version. And, because I was very charming when I was a drunk. You know, I was super fun and funny and a great time. And then one eye would close. And then all of a sudden, I had a name for him. I called him Breven. And Breven had two options. You were either going to the gay bar or you were listening to The Truth About You. Those are the two things I did. And I was a nightmare. And so I was very interested in pursuing that sort of version of me. You know, as you know, Methtacular was all about those very specific years where I was doing meth. And in this way, I think I was exorcising the years that I was an alcoholic. You know, not doing meth, but still damaging people around me.
When you decided to write this play, you sent a copy of it to your mom.
I did. Well, not when I decided to write it.
After he had finished it.
Yes,
yeah.
It was done. It had been produced in Houston, and I had been saying, no, you can't read it. Sorry, love you, can't
read
it.
You're hiding it from your mom.
Well, I didn't feel like hiding it. She knew it existed, and I just said that I would. Well, I guess I was hiding it. All right, I'll take that.
I don't want, without revealing too much, is the great reveal novel based on something that actually happened in your own family?
No.
Was your mother?
Not.
Were you concerned that your mother might feel like you were sort of lying about you're known for so much biographical work of yourself?
There was so much true in the show. There are little details that are very true. Like, I was in a production, it comes up in the play where the character based on my mother talks about the production of Guys and Dolls that Ryan was in that was so terrible. My mom brings up this production of Guys and Dolls I was in eighth grade, like every holiday. Like, oh, she's always like, oh, you're so good now, but oh, and I remember you in that production of Guys and Dolls. Oh, I sat so low in my seat. Like, it's just the way things get brought up in my family. Sure. You know, grist for the mill. But
you decided to send it to her.
Yes, and she read it.
Yeah.
And you know, her reaction was so great. We had just spent a wonderful weekend together, and we have a very close relationship. And she read it and she said, you know, she doesn't read a lot of plays. So it was, she said, it was sort of weird to just read dialogue and not hear it. But she said she could tell that it was well written, which was a lovely compliment to get from your mother. And that she wasn't mad about anything in the play or hurt the depiction of her. She thought I depicted her honestly, given these fictional circumstances. And she also was deeply grateful that I was sober. That was like the number one thing she said, because reading this version of me that never got sober, I think made her really lock into the changes that have happened.
What do you think that is the major issue with not being sober that you feel this character has, that your mother's grateful that is not part of your life?
I think I learned to look beyond the end of my own nose. I think I actually consider other people. It's not empathy and not some sort of game. You know, it's not people pleasing, which is what I used to do when I was drinking, which was I would keep score. I would do very nice things for you, but then I would expect something in return. Mm-hmm. And now if I choose to do something nice for someone, I have to be like, that's your choice. That's what you're doing. You're not getting anything back from it. You're doing this nice thing. And so it just...
dog's going haywire.
It just reoriented the way I can be in a room.
Well, it is interesting. Like, as Americans, we have a really hard time being kind or generous or, you know, empathic to other people without expecting something in return.
Yeah.
And when we do something like, you know, I work in customer service. When I am nice to a customer, they're just like, do I owe you anything? And I usually say to them, well, you can certainly do something nice for somebody else today.
Yeah.
You know, all I ask is that you pass it on.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, because it is like there is a sense of gratitude that someone wants to pay back. And to me, it's like, just pass it on. You know?
Yeah.
Esteban, you're sort of shaking your head in agreement there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think look at the times that we're living in this country right now. You know,
we're making America great again. I don't know what about you, but less government is the best kind of government. Yeah. Don't you feel?
No government. Hello.
Don't get on an airplane right anytime soon.
The ideals, the American ideals of the individual and being the underdog has now turned into like the American ideals of me, mine, now, more. Fuck everybody else. And the idea of this ladder, getting up the ladder mentality, is that it's only one person can fit on the ladder at a time. So you have to literally step on other people to get up there. So I think that the one thing that we're really lacking in this country right now is empathy, is compassion, is this idea. And I mean, that was a big thing when I went to Puerto Rico, was to learn about my culture. And the one thing I learned that is very different is that in Puerto Rico and a lot of other places, we think about the community. It's not that the individual can't rise up above, but it's that they're held by their community and lifted up. Whereas the American ideal is we need to trample on others to get up and get something. That idea of expecting something in return for the kindness.
And in a lot of ways, in many ways, it's a false narrative, too, that's kind of projected by the wealthy to make you feel like you have to do it on your own. You have to make it on your own. And then, you know, you can't do it on your own. You need people. You need to be part of something.
Caitlyn Jenner won all those Olympic medals on her own. She did all by herself. She made America great again by voting for Donald Trump.
But now she regrets it?
Yeah, and I think there is a buyer's remorse happening right now. I think there's a great awakening that's about to happen.
I hope so.
You know, are you familiar with The Artist's Way, which is a book that we're going to get into on the podcast in 2019, as well as another book called Velvet Rage?
Oh, I know both those
both
books.
Both of those books.
Yeah.
Is that the one written by a Mexican author? The Artist's Way.
Oye.
The Artist's Way?
I did The Artist's Way. So
just to explain to the listeners.
It was very popular in the 90s.
So part of it is that The Artist's Way is, in a sense, it's based on a book that looks at creativity and frustration, the writer's block, or the frustration of an artist as a form of addiction, and treats your addressing your creativity as a 12-step process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Julia Cameron put out the first, you know, Mrs. James Cameron put out this book, and it's a really practical guide of things to do. Some of it, you know, some of it does induce maybe an eye roll or two, but there were things about it that I still value so much. I was talking about you before we started recording, the morning pages,
and that's just writing a journal in the morning,
first thing in the day, and you write longhand
before your breakfast or after.
Before your first thing, like, you get up and you just start writing. And I found that I dumped so much fear and anxiety every morning. Mm. Just all of this, like, I won't get this, and I'll never do this, and this won't ever happen, and I'm not capable of this. All of this stuff. And then I would look at it as it accumulated, and I would realize how much of my time I am spending telling myself that you're just not going to make it. And it really refocused my awareness of my own brain in a way that I think I still use today.
So you think, like, as artists or people who want to be artists, we internalize the you can't do this, you're not good at this.
Yeah, I think that it's natural. It's protective. You know, it's so scary. The process of putting my play out and not being a performer in it and just letting people perform it is terrifying. It's lonely, and it is just a strange new set of emotions for me. But thank goodness I've done things like, I mean, I've done the 12 steps in real life, and, you know, and I've done The Artist's Way, and I've done therapy and all those things, because I'm able to locate the thing in my brain that says, like, see, no one ever likes what you do.
What do you mean it's lonely to create a play and then put it out there and have other people do it?
So I wrote this thing, right? And I was like, oh, this is pretty good. And then it won an award in Houston, and then it got a production. And I went down to Houston to see it, which felt less lonely because it was in a different place. And, you know, you're like, oh, great, like, cool, I'm meeting new people, and, like, they're taking you out to dinner, and it felt nice. Here, along with Christina Vallada-Vires, the director, who's a longtime friend of mine, we've been creating this thing, you know, and then it feels safe and it feels warm in the rehearsal room. And then people come, and I don't know any of them, and they will all have opinions about every single thing that happens. And it's like giving birth to a child and then putting that child in a town square being like, what do you think is wrong with that child? Anyone have an opinion about the flaws of this child that I made?
Is that true for all playwriting?
I don't know. I can say it. My guess is it'll be true for me.
Yeah. And I mean, and I've written as well, not extensively, but I wrote a pilot this year and had people perform it. And I think any playwright, really, that's the thing, because the act of writing...
A television pilot?
Yeah, a TV pilot. Oh, I guess I didn't tell you guys about that. I wrote a TV pilot about a drag queen who lives with her motorcycle mechanic boyfriend in a motorcycle shop called Uptown Girl.
Oh, so it's biographical.
Yes, it is.
Ay, qué linda.
You live in Pilsen. Don't you live in Pilsen?
Yeah, that's where the motorcycle shop is.
And how? So was it actually filmed?
No, we're going to be shooting later this year. And I went to a friend of mine in a production company here in Chicago that I used to do casting for, just to get advice and mentorship. And he, when I told him about it and everything, he was like, well, I'll produce it. And I was like, what? So I wasn't, like, ready to do that, and I feel like I've got at least 15 more drafts before it's ready. But we're going to be shooting, and we're shooting some small, like, little music videos before then to get with my, because I'm also directing it, because I have very specific ideas of how I want the shots to be.
Sure.
And so we want to practice. And so I'm going to be doing some drag videos.
Esteban, can I audition to play a customer who gets put in their place by the drag queen?
No, you cannot audition, but we will cast you.
Oh, I would love to. I've always wanted to be in a Tyler Perry play or movie where I play the white person that gets told, you know, go back to where, get back in line, or, you know, you doing this wrong.
Do you need any ugly drag queens to make your drag queen look beautiful? Because you could also do that. Like, look, you could look like these ugly ones over here.
You're both pretty, and you're both coming to the party.
Oh, I can't wait to see this. And what's the working title of the pilot?
Uptown Girl.
Uptown Girl. And you're going to get Billy Joel to license their music.
We have to get the rights, yes. We do have to get the rights, because it does end in a musical number. But it's also, speaking of autobiography, it's very much just the shenanigans that go on. Because in my real life, my boyfriend and I lived at the motorcycle shop that he works at, Motorworks, Chicago. And we lived there for 2 years. And you would think that these two radical queers could not exist in a very macho, very, you know, a lot of them are very Republican environment. But it's a really great testament to people who can not only get along but thrive in this place, because I love everyone in that shop, and I loved being there, and we had so much fun. And it was only until I got outside into the world that I was, whether I was dressed as a girl or a boy, that I would get into any kind of, you know, messed up thing.
How do the guys at the motorcycle shop that work there, and so how do they feel about, like, Chicago's leather community? Because most of it is, you know, the fashion and everything is designed, you know, and inspired by motorcycle outfits. Do you guys ever have conversations about that?
You know, we actually never really talked about it, but I'm not sure how they feel about the leather community. But when they see me dressed up in my heels and makeup, they all, you know, give cat calls, and yeah, they you know, they're flirty, and it's fun, and it's a
that's
really
how, that's how you know they're straight, because if they were gay, they'd be like, ugh, it's her again.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly interesting, you know, this is kind of what I call progress, is as LGBT people, and then certainly, like, disenfranchised voices of one kind or another as Latinx people, we're starting to see ourselves reflected in TV shows or even the reboot of One Day at a Time, as Bill Cuban. Cruz calls it, Juan Day at a Time.
Juan Day.
And we're starting to see ourselves sort of portrayed in mainstream media and television shows, to the point that, like, actually LGBT filmmakers, there was a thread on Facebook, they're all like, LGBT filmmaking is dead. We cannot find any money. We cannot find audiences.
No one's buying our movies. Nobody has DVDs anymore. Streaming sucks.
And I'm kind of like, you know, I guess all television is LGBT media at this point, isn't it? To some degree. I mean, all theater, we're sort of become so integrated to some degree that we're every TV show where there's storylines, there's everywhere.
I think that is certainly there is more presence, but I also think that we do run the risk of losing identity in that process as well. Recently, I was talking to a woman here in Chicago who was stepping down from a position of authority in a theater company. And I talked about how it would be a position I would enjoy doing, but I didn't want to interview for it because I thought a woman should replace a woman. There's so few women in control of theaters. And her response really tripped something up in me, because she said, well, I definitely wouldn't want you to interview because it would have to be, you'd have to be part of a disenfranchised community. And I was like, but wait, like, you know, I'm gay, right? And she's like, well, yeah, but that doesn't count. And I,
oh shit.
And I took a deep breath, and I understood where she was coming from, because certainly in the world of musical theater, it's not like, I mean, there's gay guys around.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I said, you know, there are so many neighborhoods in this city where I don't feel comfortable holding the hand of my husband out of
most
safety. And so,
Pilsen.
You know, so that's like, that's my day to day. So that is a disenfranchised person. And so I think sometimes this sort of, you know, we got the right to get married, it's done, you know, is hard. One of the things that I believe in, the only rule I have about casting in my shows is gay characters will be played by gay actors. Lesbian characters will be played by lesbian actors, because I'm trying to write the parts that I wished someone wrote for me.
But it also seems like it's intentional that your casting is also kind of like Disney's Cinderella. Did you see on with Bernadette Peters and Brandy? Where it's like, how does two white people give birth to a black daughter?
Well, we just want to colorblind. Yes, it's
to the point of not making, you know, genetic sense.
The one, we all know it's pretend. You walk into a theater, it's not like, ooh, is this actually happening in front of me? You know, it's pretend.
Yeah.
And so we can go beyond the idea that it has to look a certain way, because everyone gets the information they need as the play goes along. You find out first that they are brothers. You find out they are brothers of the same father. And then you find out they're brothers of the same mother. Okay, I know all that information. Moving on. And the actors I have in the show are wonderful people who bring tons of experience and life experience to these roles, and they love each other. And I would not give up any of the actors. All of my scripts say specifically, do not consider race as a reason to give or not give someone a role. I understand that, like, I'm white. I don't care that people need
the fact that you have sort of a Caucasian actor play the uptight character, and the Latino plays the loose addict, and the black character sort of like, you know, the emotional, trying to keep everybody together character. Do you think in some regards, like, you know, the race sort of colors the way we see that character?
Well, I certainly can't control how race filters things for the audience.
But as a casting person, you can control that.
But I think you
what are you looking for when you're casting the roles then?
The best people.
Yeah. But how do you define that exactly?
So the two people who came in at the end to audition for the part of the mother, one was Shereba Rivers, a black actress, and one was another actress who looks just like my mom. I mean, just like my mom.
That's freaky.
It was freaky. Mm. Shereba delivered the lines.
She's an African-American actress.
She delivered the lines. I write in these long thoughts that, as you can already probably tell if you're listening to this, I interrupt myself a lot. I change topics mid-thought, but I don't give you a guidance in the script. Sure. I'm not like, new subject. You know what I mean? You have to figure it out. She read the words and she understood what was happening. And that is what does it for me. I don't care what you look like. It doesn't. I can see a play and move beyond that. And I understand that many audiences can't and will have issues with it. But unless we're willing to do it, then people can't change. You know what I mean? It's a constant re-education process for audiences.
Would you ever consider like casting against gender?
Yeah, I think so. I don't see why not.
I guess the reservation about that would bring a camp level to the play. And you bring up some really dark topics in this play. And, you know, the set is a gray set, you know.
Yeah.
It's a comparing, and for people who haven't seen either of your shows, you know, Mythacular is almost set up like a game show. It's colorful. It's dynamic. It's funny. It's full of sounds and lights. And this is very somber and gray. And even the saran wrap walls almost recall to an insane asylum room, you know. And I don't know if that was intentional or not.
I think the idea is that at first when you see the set, you're not quite sure what it is. And so the idea was that this is no one's home. They wanted
a condo at a beach.
Yes, yeah. And it is sterile. It's a space that no one feels comfortable in 100%. Because if this was in any particular person's home, it would be a different story. Someone's got the home court advantage. No one does here.
That's why you have a love seat as opposed to a sofa.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So no one can really truly stretch out or take a nap on it.
No one gets to be comfortable.
well, that's not fun. Well, and so in a sense, like, you know, were you worried as a humorist to not make it too funny, or, you know, did you intentionally write bad jokes for the characters to deliver?
Two things. One, every audience had so far has had a completely different experience. We have had a show. There was one show where people laughed all the way through. And I mean, through some dark, dark stuff. They were just tickled by everything,
sure.
Which speaks to them as much as to the play. And you know, there are some audiences that are leaned in and completely listening and laugh at the big jokes, but not at the little ones. They're more smiling at smaller jokes. And the thing is, when I write jokes, Methtacular or this, I write jokes. My favorite jokes are jokes for eight people. You know, this sort of joke that, like, eight people are going to think it's the funniest thing they ever heard. And other people are going to be like, why are they laughing? You know, those are my favorite jokes because I think... probably because I'm a jerk.
Well, Mark and I saw the show mostly. The audience, I would describe it as mostly, you know, seniors.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's always been the demographic every night, but it did feel like you were sort of like, you failed us as parents. And the audience there, at least towards the end of the show, collectively... It was sort of like black actors yelling about racism to a white audience, you know, or young people talking about how the previous generation may have not lived up or failed us as mentors, as teachers, as parents.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that different audiences have very different reactions. I repeat that. But I think it is very interesting the people that audiences decide not to like in the play. Mm. Because I truly invite everyone to read the script and to then try to think about how often race might have something to do with their reactions and how often... their own personal lives make them defensive about certain things.
You know, I had during previews, I had some friends come and had a drink with them afterwards. And these two of the women were mothers. And one of them was telling me this story about how she was talking about sex to her 18-year-old son that was mortifying him. And she kept going and going and going and saying, and it was a hilarious story. And I was like, oh my God, you're just like the mom in the show. And she was like, no, I'm not. Absolutely not. And I was like, well, she just speaks the truth. She's like, no, 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 I'm not like that mother. And so people, you know, they go in with their own shit that they have when they're watching the play. And I mean, and that's good. That's how you should watch a play and make it personal for you. And everyone's experience has been taken away. After the show, I've had both extremes where people were like, I loved you so much. You were so sweet and love. How could anybody hate you and love? And then other people were like, you were such an asshole. You were so good at playing an asshole.
Yeah. And I go back to Puerto Rico.
Yeah! Who says that on a Congress floor?
I thought you were an asshole, weren't you?
Thank you.
You were supposed to be an asshole.
Thank
in that.
You.
Yeah. That's what you
know what? Listen,
for,
when you're
and
an asshole.
And the mother was in denial, right?
Yeah. When you're
like,
an asshole
truth
in
is
real
like
life.
Not the truth, right?
Well, and I think she's oriented her life around believing something.
Yeah.
And we all do that. Mm-hmm. Every single person, like when people ask, like, you know, I think the mother and the father were both monsters. And I'm like, no, they weren't. They were two people doing the best they could with their own. She says it so clearly. She says, everybody's got their things in life. You have yours. Your father has his. I have mine. Like, she says very basic truths about life throughout the play.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Two kids at 22.
Yeah.
Like anybody knows that when you're 22 years old and you have two children, you have no idea what you're doing.
You're just doing the best you can.
Yeah.
And, you know, did both of your parents had you guys at a very young age or?
Yeah, that bit of information is very autobiographical. And, you know, my mom has done, you know, she was a high school dropout and she was raising three kids by 26. And she now is the head of media archives at Rutgers University. She did all of that on her own, just working her way up through different things and figuring out each job as it came because she's tough. tough and she's smart. But it took a lifetime because her life began by having to, on most occasions, raise three kids on her own.
Yeah, Mark and I are different in the sense that our parents were almost senior citizens when they, you know, or later on in life, you know.
If my dad was alive, he'd be 100 in May.
Yeah.
Sure. My mother's turning 94 in March.
My father's not even alive anymore, you know. Yeah. So
he would also be 100 this year, too.
Yeah, so part of it is, like, when you talk to people whose parents are near their age, you're like, well, it must be so great to have your parents be youthful and alive and, you know, almost like your peer. And then from your vantage point, you're like, well, it must be great that your parents have the wisdom and experience to...
Well, in my family, you know, most of my brothers had their first kid when they were around 15 or 16. So when my niece called me to tell me that she was pregnant at 19, I was like, well, good for you for waiting.
Small Jokes About Monsters sets up the monster being... Who exactly? Is it humor? Is it, you have the three monsters that you describe in the beginning.
Yeah,
and those are, the different sons, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's used in a couple of ways. One, it's set up as the different kinds of comedy that people do in lives. And then also later on, the monster traits that have been set up for each of the brothers do play out in more dramatic fashion as well. And then there's also a person outside of the world of the play who I think is the only actual monster. And so that person sort of has committed an act that has really sent ripples and trauma through the whole family, making them have to figure out how to deal with it. And, you know, the way they do it is human. It's not perfect. And some of them are less perfect than others, but they're all just trying so hard to take another step forward. And so those are the only monsters, I think, that are involved.
Well, I mean, do you fear that, you know, by calling the show like that, that we might misinterpret, you know, how we relate to the characters?
I don't mind anyone misinterpreting anything. Mm-hmm. I think theater, I'd like to believe good theater, is about making people have a reaction and a conversation. And that two people come in and have very different experiences means that maybe I've created something worth talking about. I am all for a very pat, you know, production of a show that everybody already knows and like goes and is like, oh, this is going to be great. I love this play. But if I'm going to write something new, I want it to spark conversation. And Christina, the director, who's so smart and just so wonderful, and I'm so grateful that she's my partner in these things, also wanted it to be open. She wanted people, you know, if you come in being more like one of those characters in life, depending on your own psychology, you're either going to really identify with that character or hate them. Mm-hmm. You know, it just depends on how you're built. And then you orient the story around those feelings. And I think that's valuable. I think it's cool. I like that that happens.
Yeah. Small Jokes About Monsters is running until February 16th at the 16th Street Theater. Easy to remember, right?
Yeah,
Berwyn.
We're in Berwyn.
Berwyning.
Svengoolie. Shout out to Svengoolie. And Esteban Andres Cruz, you're going to be on Netflix.
Yeah.
In the next season of Orange is the New Black?
No.
RuPaul's Drag Race?
I didn't get that role. Easy.
Also.
The Netflix series. It's a lot of great Chicago people are in it. And Joe Swanberg directed.
What is it? Is it a sitcom?
It's adults navigating love and sex in Chicago and what that's like. And so
it's not a reboot of a TV show from the 80s.
No.
That is so great.
And it was my first TV show that I ever shot that was all improvised.
Oh, wow. Because tell us about how you got this role. You went to the audition. And they asked you to tell them horror stories about hookup apps.
Yeah, well, there were no sides to prepare. Normally, you get a script and you have to go in there memorized. And they're like, no, it's just going to be an interview. And I was like, great. So I went in, and I'm in this office all the time, and the girls know me, and so they're like, great, so are you dating right now? And I was like, well, I'm in a committed relationship. And they're like, well, have you ever dated? And I was like, sure. And they're like, did you ever use dating apps? And I was like, well, yeah, but, you know, Grindr is mostly for hookups. And they're like, okay. And they're like, will you tell us a horror story? And I was like, sure. So I...
Now I want to hear what the horror story is.
So this guy was fucking me. And
wait, how'd you meet this person?
Grindr.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you swiped right and then you met
up with him. And then we met and he came over when I was in Uptown and he's fucking me. And then his phone rings and he answers it. And I'm like, excuse me. And he's like, oh, no.
Wait. So his dick was inside you and you pulled out.
I pulled that dick out.
Because he was on the phone while he was fucking
me. And
he was multitasking.
And I said, out, dick, out. And
like, fuck me harder. Fuck me harder.
Yeah. I hope your mom hears this. And so he's taking the call. He's like, don't worry, it'll be a minute. And I was like, yes, it will. Get out. And I kicked him out. And then the girls in the audition room were mortified. And I was like, great, well, I'm never getting called in again. And then the next week, I got a call from my agent on Friday saying that I was taping on Monday. And I got in there waiting for the script. And then the director's like, oh, yeah, no, it's improvised, and here's what we're doing. And then he told me the scenario, and we did it in one take, and it was super fun. And I sang a song that I wrote, which I thought was going to get published, but now it's not. It got cut. But
Maldito sea.
I know. But they said that the scene is really funny, and I'm looking forward to seeing it in season 3.
Esteban, what did you learn about your experience in Puerto Rico? Because we never touched on that.
Oh, yeah.
Last time you were on the show, you were telling the listeners that you were going to Puerto Rico to help rebuild it.
Yeah, I
thought you didn't. Did you come back and do a podcast when I was in Norway?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think
so. No, senor.
Did. No. I mean, it's there was so much that I learned. I mean, I was there for 3 months, and, you know, when I was raised, our father had always taught us to be proud to be Puerto Rican. Like, you're Puerto Rican, be proud, proud. So pride was a huge thing, but I never knew why. And that was, like, one of the number one motivating reasons was to find out why should I be proud? And I learned that, like, in less than a week. And it was despite all of these things that have happened to these people, despite being disenfranchised and discounted, they still have this great dignity about them. And the way that they treat other human beings with respect and compassion. And we would go and work on these people's roofs. And I remember this one family, Victor, was his house, this older gentleman, and his daughter and his grandkids lived there. And they didn't have a lot of money. But when we finally finished the roof, they made a lunch for us with lechon, arroz con gandule, and habichuel, everything. They made everything. And all the other workers were like, oh, my God, thank you so much. That's so sweet. And I was like, guys, you don't understand. This is a Christmas dinner. This guy took all the money that he had, and he said, no tengo plato, no tengo oro, pero tengo un corazón grande. And I was like, this dude just gave us everything he has because he's so grateful. And that kind of pride, that kind of dignity was something that I was like, okay, now I get it. It's because we still, you could be poor, you could have shit, but our clothes will, when I was a kid, we might have had secondhand clothes, but they were always clean. And, you know, and it's that kind of thing, this sense of pride of who we are and dignity.
I think Orgullo Boricua.
Orgullo. And when I was at Pride.
Oh, Bori.
I was in.
They call it Boris in the United Bodies. States.
And I was telling the people in Yabucoa, yeah. I had to go to San Juan because I had to deliver 2,000 condoms. And I ended up being a part of the Pride Parade in San Juan and passing out condoms. And when they asked, like, what are you going to? And I would say, la fiesta, Orgullo de los Gays. And then they got it.
Would you like me to help you demonstrate how to put on that condom?
Oh, my God.
And you just did something in New York at the Lab Theater. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is the third time I've gotten to collaborate with... my hero and now my friend, Stephen Adley Geergis, in the Labyrinth Theater on a new play that he's writing, which I can't give the details out because it's commissioned by Warner Brother, like they had just commissioned to write Misery into a musical. Well, they're doing the same thing with a certain film of theirs.
They're turning Alien into a musical, finally.
And I'm the alien baby. No, don't not swallow. That one. But it's a really beautiful play. And like Geergis's other works, there's something about celebrating these people, again, who you would otherwise discount, and say that there's still dignity, there's still human dignity in these people, even though they may have done some things or made messed up choices. The reason why they do these things is for love. And so it's a love story. And I'm thrilled that John Ortiz is my love interest in this. Ooh. And David Zayas is in the cast. And Stephen McKinley Henderson has done a reading with us. And just incredible, these incredible Broadway actors. And the first time I did it was a year ago when I won the Fox Fellowship. I went out there and Stephen invited, we met for the first time. He invited me back to do the reading. And he'd never seen me act before, but just we've known each other and been chasing each other on Facebook and finally met. And I got my first time ever to perform for him was in his play with a role that he kind of sort of wrote for me, with all of these people who have been my heroes for the longest time. And now I'm on stage with them. So we're doing that again. And we did that again. We did it in Indiana. I went and we had the company retreat in Indiana in August. And then had the last reading this last Sunday, and then hopefully the show will be produced on Broadway, and then I will be there doing it with them. That's the goal.
And then finally, we're gonna get our celebrity jacuzzi party with champagne.
Yeah,
yes, Poppy.
I smell so good.
When lechon, you'll be the pig, roasted pig, honey.
That's right, and I only take bubble baths.
Stephen, you have a show coming up, Mona Q, age 38, playing at the Greenhouse Theater.
Yeah, this is my newest play, and it is a story of loosely, legally based on the character Ramona Quimby. If you know those books from growing up, Ramona Quimby, age 8, Ramona and Beezus.
Yeah. She's like a kid detective or something.
Oh, no. She's a kid who's like sort of always acting up, and she came from like this working class family. And as a kid reading them, it meant a lot to me because like they were always sort of, it was a family really struggling, but she was still having fun. And I wrote this play because I gave the books to my niece, and my brother, my older brother, was reading the books to her, and he texted me. He's like, "Oh, I understand why you loved these books when you were a kid. Ramona reminds me of you." And he was like, "You know, you should write another solo show, and you should play her as an adult." And at the same moment, we sent texts that I swear must have passed each other, you know, in the sky, because at the same moment I was texting him, he was texting me, "She's definitely divorced." And so I began with that. And it started as this monologue piece, but now it's turned into a full-fledged play where Ramona is 38, now Mona. Mona is 38 years old. She's divorced and living with her sister. And she's trying to tell us where she is in life. And while she's making her sister and her gay friend play all the parts in the play, she's like, keep telling them like, "No, now you're this person." So then, so it's doing that for us, that meta theatricality. And she ends up going on a road trip to take her name off of a Holocaust trivia distribution list. And along the way, she figures
what
out.
What is a Holocaust what?
So my friend Fran, who is about to give birth any moment, when she's depressed, she does depression Googling. And so she Googles depressing things so she doesn't feel as bad about her life. And she, through that, ended up on this Holocaust trivia distribution list, where she would get texts of different Holocaust trivia, and she would forward me these texts, and I'd be like, "Fran, stop sending these to me."
My God.
And she was like, "I can't. I don't know how to get myself off the list." And so that's what sparked the idea. So this character, Mona, is trying to get her name off this list, and she ends up taking a road trip to the office that like does the actual trivia. And along the way, she meets people and has a hero's journey where she sort of rediscovers herself. And at the end of the play, we, you'll find out kind of like, I like writing plays where people don't go from A to Z, because I don't always believe that. Mm-hmm. I prefer a play where someone goes from A to B, and I think that's what this play does. She takes this hero's journey and ends up taking sort of one step forward.
One show that you're working on that sounds really exciting is Stephen Strafford. Is Stephen Strafford as Anne Gillian in the Anne Gillian story, starring Anne Gillian as Anne Gillian?
So, do you know the Anne Gillian story? Do you remember that?
It was a made-for-TV movie.
Yes.
Where she plays herself, where she goes, the actress Anne Gillian, best known for the sitcom
It's a Living.
It's a Living, where they play waitresses in a high-rise restaurant with a wisecracking
piano player.
Sassy piano player.
She also played Jane Mansfield in a made-for-TV movie, and I shit you not, she actually says this line to a Hollywood producer, says, "I will work my head off in this business."
And so Anne Gillian got breast cancer.
Yes.
And very bravely at the time spoke publicly about the experience.
And yes. And then did this TV movie about playing herself. And, you know, it won awards and she was lauded for it. And now it feels like of a time where it's sort of campy and a little schlocky. And I began... something struck in my head. Someone asked, like, where's Anne Gillian these days? And I was like, oh, God, where is she? And then she's a public speaker. She's doing very well for herself. And I was interested. I got the script and I was interested to see the things that are the same about my exploring my drug addiction and Methtacular. Other people are always telling me how brave I am. Yeah. And so I was interested in the similarities between us. And then also... my mom in the last year had breast cancer and then has survived breast cancer, which is amazing because she caught it so early that it was really a very quick process for her. But there's a lot of crossover. There's a lot more crossover between Anne Gillian and I than I would expect. So the play will be some stories and some acting out of the script where I am just being me in the role of Anne Gillian, like not acting like Anne Gillian, but just like being me in the script. While so it's going to go in and out of this script and also telling stories about cancer and fame and what it means to be famous and what it means to fall from fame. And why is that even important to anyone? You know, I'm sort of fascinated by all of it. It is a giant mess of a script at this point. And I'll be interested to see when and if it gets into shape. But I love working on it.
Can anybody here sing the It's a Living sitcom?
Wait, I think I can do it.
Wow.
Life's not the French Riviera. Da-na-na. You know it. Life's not a charity ball. And then it goes, something about bed of roses, but that's the way the traffic flows, cause it's a living, yeah.
You know, when I was a kid watching that show, I was like, I want to eat in a high-rise restaurant.
It was so fancy.
It was so fancy.
I'm sorry. Did the restaurant turn or something? Or was it just in the
The gimmick was that they were kind of like isolated. It was, you know, a workplace comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the maitre d' was a well-known actress at the time.
Nancy something or
she
other.
She was in the sitcom Soap.
Yes.
With Katherine Helmund, who later played Mona and who's the boss.
Yeah.
But, I think Katherine Helmund was a guest star. And
Crystal Bernard was on it.
So a lot of 80s comedy, you know, legends were on that show.
The wife of the bad guy in 9 to 5 was in it.
Yes. That's the same person from Soap. Yes. Yeah, that's right.
And so that show, it just made it seem like eating in a high-rise restaurant was a good idea.
Yeah.
But have you actually eaten in one of those things?
I don't think so.
The food is always terrible.
Oh, so because it's like that place where you get that little vegetable medley and like a scoop
frozen.
Of mashed potatoes.
Yeah. Because you have to, you know, I guess the idea was trying to get the food up into this tower. And then you're kind of like just isolated, you know? It's like when we were kids, we went to Toronto, to the Niagara Falls, and we went to the Canadian Tower, to the top that overlooks the Niagara Falls, and ate at that restaurant. And the food was just like worse than airplane food. It was terrible.
Yeah.
You know, so. But anyways, Angelian is coming to you.
Someday.
Someday soon. I love these nutty shows, and I love that you guys produce and develop so much great work. Esteban Andres Cruz and Steven Strafford. Am I pronouncing your names correctly? It's a mouthful there. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
If people want to follow y'all you guys are on Instagram, Facebook Land, all that stuff. We're going to put links on the website, but...
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Steven Strafford, my full name. Steven's with a V, and Strafford is Doctor of Farts backwards.
That's how I remember your name. It was because Dr. Farts back. Yeah. You always remember that.
Esteban.
And Instagram Pepe. And Twitter, Mr. Ballerino, MrBallerino. And 16thStreetTheater.org, that's where we're at. You can find us before we move into our new home. This play is at our old space on Ridgeland and 16th. And then in March, we move into our new permanent home on Harlem.
Oh, wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Honey, we're right now trying to raise funds to replace our main computer that we record the podcast on. It is having huge problems. It needs a new logic board. So we just decided to basically trade this one in and get a new one. If you want to help us out, go to GoFundMe.com/FeastOfFunComputer and help us.
I also want to remind people the best way to support the podcast is to become a Plus member. We are on our 15th season right now. We are among the first 50 podcasts out there, and we can do this, and we can continue to do it because of people just like you who step forward and support our one-of-a-kind programming, and you can do that at feastoffun.com/plus.
Por favor.
Por favor. Please.
Por un amor.
You guys, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and, you know, come back anytime. Always a delight having both of you on.
I absolutely love your work, and I love your guys' sensibility, so it's always great talking to you both.
Thanks so much.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.